There we go. All right, Mr. Chairman, you're recording. You can take us into session if you like.
All right, thank you very much. Well, welcome everybody to our warm August agenda. I guess that's the warm welcome that we get in Arizona summers. We'll go ahead and call the meeting to order, and we will do a roll call, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Start out with Jagadishan Krishna Murthy.
Present.
Doug Lang for Brian Kirkland.
Present.
Eddie Cook.
Here.
Jeffrey Fleetham.
Here.
David Byers.
Here.
Ryan Murray for Tim Romer.
I am here, sir. Thank you.
Lev Gonick.
Here.
J.R. Sloan.
Here.
Representative Nguyen. Senator Gray. And Rebecca Pereira for Richard Stavnik.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, you have a quorum.
All right. Thank you, Chuck. Again, we will go ahead and step into our first item, which will be a review of our recording from April, July 20th as our meeting minutes. And if there aren't any comments, I will take a motion with regard to approving the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I move to approve.
Thank you, Eddie. Do we have a second?
Second.
Gosh, there were three of you. I'll award it to Jeggy. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and step in then to our first item for review and approval, which is the Department of Administration bringing forward a project related to 911 compliance.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Karen Whiteford. I'm an engagement manager with the Department of Administration. I'm joined here today by members of the Arizona Department of Administration who will introduce themselves after a brief overview of the project. The Arizona Department of Administration is seeking approval of a solution to bring the state's voice network, also known as ASNET, into compliance with federal legislation surrounding Carey's Law and Ray Baum's Act by providing state personnel the ability to identify their precise physical location for 911 emergency services. At this time, I will turn this over to the project team, who will introduce themselves, present additional information regarding the proposed project, and answer any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you, Karen, for the introduction. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jake Sterling. I'm a project manager with the Enterprise Project Management Office at the Arizona Department of Administration, and I'll be presenting the 911 compliance project. This presentation should take under 20 minutes. Other members on this team include Stephen Jenkins, who is the Arizona Network's director. He is the service owner of this project. Paul Copeland is the infrastructure architect and technical lead on this project. Suzanne Tazvibi is the Arizona Department of Administration Chief Operating Officer, and she's the project sponsor. And Lumen and 911 Inform are our vendor and integrator and subject matter experts. You could go to the next slide, please. So the business issue that we're facing is legislative compliance. We need to fill the gap that new legislation has created in the soft phone world that went into effect January 1st of this year, which affects state agencies that utilize soft phones under the existing Arizona Networks ASNET 3 contract. A soft phone is a software that makes telephone calls using Wi-Fi instead of a hardwired connection. So the first legislation is Carey's Law. And to meet the requirements of Carey's Law, multi-line telephone systems, which are phone systems that allow multiple people to be on the phone at the same time, must support direct dialing of 911. So this means that a person dialing 911 will not require any kind of access code or a prefix number for outbound 911 calls. The second legislation is the Rave Bombs Act. And to meet the requirements of the Rave Bombs Act, a dispatchable location of where a 911 call originates must be furnished both internally to on-site staff and to the public safety answering point, or in other words, the PSAP. And this is a call center where emergency calls are initiated. So this newly required dispatchable location information, it must be actionable and include details such as building, floor, room number, and any other relevant information for first responders. Previously, a general street address was provided, but this is no longer sufficient or adequate. And historically, this type of information has been very difficult to collect and also expensive to deliver, especially considering remote workers who could have a desk phone at the office, and they could also be working remotely via laptop. Now, the worker is active in two separate locations, both of which tether to the same phone number and extension. Therefore, this worker's location information is not updated, and a 911 call would be routed to the PSAP that covers their work location, which will delay response times. And a great example of this is a call placed today through the IP address of the internet service provider Cox. Cox routes to a PSAP in California because locations are not accurate per Cox's IP address. Now, also along with remote workers, this is also going to impact state visitors who may place a 911 call within the boundary of the Capitol Mall buildings. But despite the issue arising from a legislative gap, the most important aspect is, of course, safety of on-site employees, remote workers, and state visitors. Now, moving into the benefits to the state and constituents, again, with the ultimate goal of safety and the legislative goal of compliance, our direct dialing of 911 will achieve compliance with Carey's Law and provide ease of access and usability to a 911 dialer. Having dispatchable locations furnished to both internal staff and that PSAP will achieve compliance with the Rave Bombs Act and facilitate effective and precise emergency response. By achieving both of these requirements, we'll avoid any monetary penalties that are associated with non-compliance of this legislation. And since we'll also be utilizing a geofence, which sets a boundary over a geographical location, if anyone, not just a state employee, makes a 911 call in this boundary, we'll have all the benefits stated above for that 911 call as well. And again, ultimately, most importantly, lives can be saved. Next slide, please. So the proposed solution is called the 911 Inform Location Discovery Solution. This is a SaaS solution for soft phones. 911 Inform LDS will achieve compliance with both Carey's Law and the Rave Bombs Act because it is a notification and emergency management solution that provides police, first responders, and key building personnel with actionable and relevant information and enhances situational awareness. So these key personnel receive relevant and accurate location updates in near real time. As a comparison, other solutions will take 48 hours to update this information and cause further delays in response times. Now, whether a caller is calling from an IP, a digital, or an analog station, and whether the caller's at work or home or another remote location, the 911 callers, internal staff, and first responders will all benefit from reduced response times and clearer communication. So for context, the way that this works today is that a 911 call is first routed to the Phoenix Police Department, then it gets sent to the Department of Public Safety. This information is not precise or actionable. Furthermore, a facility's contact, such as a physical building security personnel, may not be notified of the emergency until first responders have arrived. 911 Inform will send the precise and actionable location information we need, simultaneously to the Phoenix Police Department and the State Department of Public Safety and a facilities contact. And this will reduce response times and create clearer communication between emergency responders and internal staff. Now, moving into how this solution is implemented, it will integrate with PBX and a client for Jabber and Genesis soft phones. Now, PBX allows businesses to operate internal phone systems and use fewer lines from the phone company, while Jabber and Genesis are those soft phone softwares that we were talking about. So this PBX integration works on the back end from IP phones on the state network under the ASNet 3 contract, which is between Arizona Networks and Lumen Technologies. Deployment of the 911 Inform LDS will be pushed through Tanium, which is a tool that the state uses to streamline software deployments, or it will be pushed manually through agencies' IT departments if they don't use Tanium. There will also be an end user license agreement to install the Jabber and Genesis softphone clients on the user's desktop. So by digitizing floor plans, the location information will be delivered to the correct PSAP through Rapid SOS, which is a data platform that securely links data to 911 and first responders. Next slide, please. Okay, looking at project responsibilities, we'll start with the agency and then move into the vendor and then the shared responsibilities. So starting on the left, agency responsibilities include, very first and foremost, providing key agency information to the vendor. So for 911 calls to be able to furnish the actionable and precise location info, we need to gather all the floor plans from impacted agencies in order to digitize those floor plans and implement the solution. This is the most crucial piece of information that we need to gather. Some other info includes, but isn't limited to, telephony configurations and network information. Agencies will also need to approve the digitization of the floor map that they provide so the vendor can begin the implementation process. So this step, the process of this step is the agency provides the key info to the vendor digitizes, agencies approve that digitization, then implementation can begin. Now, number three, lastly, agency IT teams will be responsible to deploy the solution manually if they don't have Tanium. Now, we recognize that this is a lot of responsibility on agencies. So in order to achieve success here, we've been gathering three targeted points of contact from each impacted agency. And this includes an agency contact, an IT contact, and a physical security contact specifically for 911 calls. We've also drafted an official statewide communication to be disseminated next week, and we've already sent a preliminary communication to agency heads, chief information officers, and chief information security officers. We're also working closely with the engagement management team to bring awareness to agencies. So we'll really lean on the engagement managers to support with communication and the procurement of this key agency info and help us get into some more high visibility committee meetings where we can present this project. Now on the right side, vendor responsibilities will be to digitize the floor plans that will be used to furnish those precise locations. They'll install the software that allows for implementation of the solution. They'll conduct quality assurance to ensure that key info and software implementation is free of errors. And lastly, the vendor will host and maintain the environment in the AWS GovCloud. Now looking at shared responsibilities in the middle of the page, between the vendor and state agencies, first, the management of the project by both parties supplying project managers that will work together to deliver a successful project. Both the state and the vendor will conduct user acceptance testing to ensure that the experience and the usability for users of the solution is acceptable. The state and vendor will collaborate to deploy the software across impacted agencies. And lastly, training will be provided to the agency IT departments, as well as end users, through training sessions with the vendor and through continued training opportunities internally with the state. Next slide, please. Okay, moving into the project timeline. So this project will begin towards the end of August, and execution will conclude before the calendar year end of December 31st, so we meet our compliance deadline. This project will utilize a hybrid waterfall and agile methodology, which means that project phases will execute concurrently at the same time, as illustrated by the phases that we see below. So moving into these phases, starting at the top, data gathering will begin immediately. The first milestone of this project will be collecting all the key agency info by the end of September, and again, really using the engagement managers to help us procure that information. Once the data begins flowing in from agencies, software installation can initiate. So this includes those PBX phone integrations, testing of infrastructure, and deploying desktop clients. Next, the digitization process begins, which includes the steps of digitizing and approving floor plans. And this also includes mapping grids to designated geofencing locations. During this phase, we'll also be meeting another very important milestone of implementing 50% of floor plans by mid-November. Halfway through digitization, user acceptance testing will begin and mainly consist of testing IP phone registrations and testing PSAPs, both for the office and geofence locations for those PSAPs. The last phase of project execution will be training for end users, IT, and physical security. At this time, we'll meet 100% of implementation of floor plans, so all impacted agencies will have the fully deployed desktop client, and this will allow us to achieve legislative compliance by December 31st. And last but not least, after achieving compliance, we'll use January to land the solution, which is another important phase of closing a project. This will be comprised of managing multiple elements of change. These changes include things like ongoing training, conducting agency touch points that will ensure smooth transitions of adoption, and also managing a steering committee that we're putting together. So this will provide a forum for both decision-making as well as continued adoption and change management after the project officially closes. Next slide, please. Okay, looking at project costs, we'll run through these row by row. So starting with the second row, there will first be a non-recurring first-year professional and outside services cost, and this is to develop the solution. Then as we move into the third row, license and maintenance fees, those stem from hosting and operational costs, which will be incurred on a monthly basis over the term of the ASNet 3 contract. And also, as the state's fiscal year is not aligned with the calendar year, you'll see that half of the annual expense will be incurred in both fiscal year 23 and fiscal year 28. And then you'll see the full annual cost incurred from fiscal year 24 through fiscal year 27. Now, moving into the fourth row, you'll notice a credit from the vendor, which will be applied to the first year non-recurring developmental cost above. And in short, this credit is derived from overcharged property taxes from Lumen Technologies under the ASNet 3 contract. So looking at totals, this brings the total development cost of $1.15 million with the credit down to $515,000. Total operational costs are $2.26 million, and the grand total with the vendor credit is $2.77 million compared to the $3.4 million without the credit. Next slide, please. So a little more on how this solution is funded. The funding for this will be from all agencies that are impacted, and it's based on each agency's respective percentage of voice seats that they have on the ASNet 3 contract. So again, this will be a monthly recurring expense that's tacked onto the existing telecommunications expense management invoice, which is also known as the TEM invoice. And to help offset some of these monthly recurring costs as much as possible, the Enterprise Infrastructure and Communications Division is identifying areas where we can cut current costs for Arizona networks. Next slide, please. what success looks like. So starting on the left, the project milestones will reflect the phases of the project that we saw in the timeline, such as data gathering, floor plan digitization, user acceptance testing, training and user documentation, and implementation. Then moving to the right, the way that we measure our success is by tracking the 800 floor plans that will need to be uploaded and ensuring that digitization and approval of these floor plans is completed so we can allow the vendor to implement this software. We'll also track desktop deployment of all the endpoints, or in other words, things like laptops, smartphones, and desk phones, with an emphasis on the endpoints with Jabber and Genesis because of the explicit legislation around soft phones. Now, through these success criteria, we will achieve legislative compliance by December 31st of this year. Next slide, please. So that is the 911 compliance project. Thank you, everyone, for your time. Do we have any questions?
Thank you, Jake. I will open it up to the committee for any questions. Eddie.
Quick question. For the remote user that is not in the state, and for whatever reason they're on travel or doing business work outside the state, how does that impact the intelligence and understanding where those remote users are? Or do they just automatically drop off the system because they're outside the state?
This is Stephen Jenkins. I'd be glad to answer that. No, the system actually works across multiple states. It will recognize the IP address, and it prompts the end user who's using Jabber or even Genesis Call Center at that point in time to actually manually input that address in that state. And it ties in and will work with the routing protocols under the 911 laws to route that call to those local PSAP areas. We'll just need to really identify those out-of-state employees and do some testing as part of our UAT project.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Fleetham.
Yes, thank you very much, Jake, for a great presentation. I've got a question. It might be some of my ignorance on this, but will this affect our Genesis system at all? Is there any sort of negative effects in that?
No negative effects. Okay. And this is Stephen Jenkins again. Yep, no problem. No negative effects. Just again, if somebody's home remotely using their home network, they need to make sure and provide their IT into their location information. And the end user is able to do favorites. You know, if they work two or three different locations, you know, 3 days out of the week, they can set up favorites and be able to hit that button when they're logging into the system to help speed up that end user experience.
Okay. Thank you, Stephen.
And maybe something I can add on top, Director, for you as well. For folks that are working within a state facility and using a soft phone within a state facility, that's going to be auto-detected.
Right.
And so they won't actually have to, they won't be prompted to select an address. That'll be automatically populated in the system just to make that easier for them.
That's good to know. We haven't had hard phones in, I think, over a year now. So
yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? A point of clarification I think that may be important here is that this solution covers those executive branch agencies that are taking advantage of the ASNET. I know we have some that are not obligated to ride the state's the ASNET voice network. This solution is not specific to ASNET, so if you have an interest, this is a solution that could be maybe of interest to you, and you can take advantage of. So, also just making sure that if you aren't aware of the Carrie's Law and Ray Bonds Act, that stuff is coming quickly, and you do have an obligation to provide this type of service to your employees. So, Eddie, what do you got?
You bring up a great point, JR. As it relates to other agencies like Maricopa County, is there a cooperative partnership that could happen between the state and the county? How expansive is this solution as it relates to other government agencies?
So I'll answer from what I know, and Stephen, correct me if I'm wrong. Right now, the scope, Eddie, of what we've done is specific to addressing the need for the state. I don't have the answer off the top of my head to the question of whether the contract vehicle that we procured this through is available under the cooperative. But we can certainly get an answer for you on that. But in terms of this, from what I understand of the solution and its scalability, it is not specific to any phone system. It's not specific to Jabber or Genesis in terms of its ability to support soft phone clients. So I think it's a solution that can work with any environment that you can have. So certainly something worth looking at.
Okay, thank you.
If there are any other questions, I'll turn it back over to you, Karen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Asset is recommending that the PIDG be approved with the following three conditions. One, should development costs exceed the approved estimates by 10% or more, or should there be significant changes to the proposed technology scope of work or implementation schedule, the agency must amend the PIDG to reflect the changes and submit it to ADOA Asset and ITAC, if required, for review and approval prior to further expenditure of funds. Two, monthly reporting on the project status is due to ADOA Asset no later than the 15th of the month following the start of the project. Failure to comply with timely project status reporting will affect the overall project health. The first status report for this project is due on October 15th, 2022. Three, prior to system production environment launch or go live, the agency must work with the Department of Administration and the Department of Homeland Security Cyber Command to assure the system security plan document is completed and approved by Cyber Command in order to ensure that the selected solution will provide an appropriate level of protection for state data.
All right. Any question on those conditions? Okay, if there are no questions, then we'll go ahead and take a motion with regard to the project.
I'll move to approve with the conditions as presented.
Thank you, Director Fleetham. Do we have a second?
Mr. Chair, I'll second.
I'll give that one to you, Doug. all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, that's unanimous vote. Thank you, Jake and Stephen and the project team. Good luck with your implementation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, our next item up for review here is the Department of Public Safety bringing forward phase two of their public services portal.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committees. My name is Captain Jacob Pruitt. I'm with the Arizona DPS. And I'll be presenting on behalf of DPS for phase two of the portal. Next slide. And with me today, I have Phil Case, which is our Department Budget Officer, Carolee Berry, which is our ISO, and Randy Williams, which is our Chief Procurement Officer. They will be available for questions if needed. And as stated on the slide, I will be the project manager for this project. Next slide. So our operational issue is DPS has legislatively mandated to be provided licensing and regulatory services. Because the regulation varies and the business processes do as well, it makes it difficult for citizens and to be inconsistent with business with DPS to conduct that efficiently across the board. So we have a highly manual process that we do for these licensures and regulatory services, so that results in a loss of efficiency, and there's prone to errors for employees physically entering this into the DPS backend systems. Also, increase in application volumes could create a backlog if DPS personnel staffing becomes reduced. As stated before, this is phase two. We've already implemented phase one of this, and so the benefits to the agency have already been realized. So in 2020, DPS launched this phase one of the newly designed public service portal, or the PSP. So the PSP provided customers with a centralized location to conduct business with DPS. And the deployment of the PSP has already provided customers with lower processing times with historic processing times for DPS. So as of July 26, the average time for a security guard license with no criminal history is 3.48 days, and a fingerprint clearance card with no criminal history was 1 day. So we're going to expand on that with phase two to include 4 additional units. So these units are the criminal history review and challenge, student transportation bus driver certifications, vehicle impounds, and the applicant processing team, which they're responsible for background checks for licensures and employment. Next slide. So our proposed solution. So our main purpose is to provide world-class customer service to the citizens. We have contracted with Accenture to add these 4 additional DPS units. Accenture is our current contractor that developed and maintains phase one. So again, the new 4 business units will be created using a simple, easy-to-follow, customer-oriented, human-centered design. It also connects to the DPS systems on the back end through APIs. It also is going to use a step-by-step guided process to ensure the customers interact with the proper business and they receive the services that they are requesting. It's going to allow the customers to create personal accounts, which means that they can store some limited information on their account, communicate securely with the department, and apply for several different services without creating and duplicating some of these efforts. It also provide the customer the ability to update information and track their process in real time using a dashboard. It also provides a mechanism for secure document transfers in and out of DPS. And then it increases efficiency by providing a method to validate the submissions instantaneously in real time by the customer, and it makes corrections by line item validations. And then other agencies actually can interact with the PSP either via APIs or through accounts that they can set up securely with the public service portal. Next slide. So our proposed solution, so the department has currently got a contract with Accenture for the development, implementation, and maintenance of phase one of the portal. DPS has invested a significant amount of time and resources and funding to this solution, and we feel that moving the solution to another system would not be in the best interest of the state of Arizona. And additionally, phase two is a continuation of an earlier approved ITAC project under PIDGE PS19011. And the technology of the solution is going to be deployed on the current AWS GovCloud platform that provides secure, consistent data. And it also, again, will be connected to the DPS backend systems by non-proprietary language that's consistent with the currently used APIs during phase one. Next slide. So the project responsibilities. So on the far left, you have the agency. DPS will be responsible for providing those web service APIs, user acceptance testings, the timely deliverables. We also require to ensure services provided meet and comply with all local laws and regulations, and as well as collect any fees associated with the services. And on the far right, the vendor or contractor, they will be responsible for design iterations, developing those iterations, security performance testing, and then user acceptance testing and support. And then in the middle of the shared, we are both responsible for planning and initiating the project, system integrations, and then the maintenance of the portal once it's live. Next slide. So the project timeline here, at the top you see M1 to M11, that is months of the project. So month one is August and month 11 is June. So during the month of August, month one is planning and initiating the project. Also to start the planning and design iterations for sprints. So we have 9 sprints that we will be conducting. And we're going to be using a leapfrog type system where as we develop some of those sprints, then it goes into the next session of sprints, say iteration 3, then the development of iteration 1 and 2 will commence at the same time. The planning and design iterations are 20 weeks and the development iterations are 27 weeks. And then towards month 8, we'll complete those developments, integrate them into the system tests, conduct security and performance testing. And once all those tests have a green light, we'll do a code merge and regression test with the phase one. Once all those green lights, we're going to conduct a UAT with the business units themselves. And then after that is all green lighted and everything's a go, we will deploy that in month 11. Next slide. So the project cost, there's only a one-time cost currently right now for the actual development and implementation, which is a little over $3,042,500. And then maintenance costs after that between fiscal year 24 and 27 are 1.3 for fiscal year 24 and then 1.9 for 25, and then it's consistent 2.2 for 26 and 27. It's to be noted, again, the contract for the maintenance fees that we're currently under with Accenture differ from the state fiscal year, so that's why there is some difference in those numbers for the consistency purposes. And we do have a current contract for 4 years to provide support to phase one maintenance. So the overall project cost to include the initial implementation and development and the maintenance cost is a little about $7.7 million. Next slide. So what does success look like? So project milestones, again, look similar to the ones on the previous slide. So we have that initial and detailed planning, kickoff meeting, prep and execution. Then we have our design sprints, 0 through 9. And then we have development sprints, 1 through 9. And then we have several testings, the integration, performance, and security testing. And then the user acceptance testing at the end. Once everything has a green light, we'll do the code merge and regression test. And then we'll deploy the product into the production server. So how do we measure success? So we took the same approach from phase one to phase two. So after the first quarter, success will be measured by each business unit showing a measurable increase of the portal use of 10% over the baseline for the next three quarters, and then 5% per year thereafter. So to give an example, phase one was completed. The percentage of the portal usage over the last year was 75% over the paper portion. So that means that 75% of all of our business that we conducted actually was done on the portal versus paper process. So the initial volume that, and another measure of success that we had for phase one, is the initial volume was estimated to be 60,000 users. After the first year of operation, transactions were 146,000, and then with 185,000 new accounts. So almost triple, over triple that initial estimation. So again, for the success of phase two, we're going to have those four units, the review and challenge, the bus driver certifications, vehicle impounds, and applicant processing team. And they're going to be measured in a similar set of 10%, and then for the three quarters, and then 5% year after. And just to give you an example of the success of phase one, the affected units that were associated with the portal right now have an approximately vacancy rate of 60%. And the processing times that we've had for these units were not adversely affected due to the success of the portal. So for a number of reasons, last month clearance cards, which they are on the public service portal now for phase one, had approximately 17,000 applications that came in. 14,000 of those were processed through the portal, and that equates to 1,400 man hours of data entry that we saved, which equates to 8 full-time employees that we would have to have to enter in those applications. So that's a huge success from that previous project, and we're just trying to build on that to provide the citizens and Arizona a more streamlined process to get services out and people's jobs more quickly. Next slide. And that concludes the slideshows. If anybody have any questions?
All right. I will open it up to the committee for questions. I had one just on the last slide, which is not probably critical to the project, but I just wanted to try and understand a bit more about the 10% over baseline seemed, I'll say, for not knowing the context of what baseline means, if you achieve 75% of last year, setting a target of 10% seems kind of low. And no, so yes. I want to make sure that if there's something I don't understand about how those targets were set.
Yes, sir. So the reason why we came up with that was obviously the previous iteration of that for phase one, but we can't require the public to use the portal. So it's all incumbent upon us getting this information out, and we know that it's going to be slow going. We're going to do a campaign several months prior to push this information out and show the benefits of it. We do have a baseline of the previous fiscal year's applications that the business units have created. So we do have that baseline. So that's why we're hoping to push that 10% per quarter or for the next three quarters, and then 5% after that, because we just don't understand how the public's going to react. And what we didn't want to do is we didn't want to say 50%, and then if we come up with 45%, would that be a failure? Which is not, because it's still reducing the amount of man hours that are taken to input these manual applications.
Sure, sure. Thank you. I appreciate that. Mr. Byers. Sure.
Yeah, Captain, thanks for the presentation. Let me see if I understand, I guess, the fourth group that you have you're going to put into the portal. Are you indicating that for all of us who either certify or employ people that have to have a criminal history background check, will this will allow us to produce the process those electronically through this portal?
Yes, so it doesn't matter the applicant. All personnel under these different groups will be able to be processed through this and then sent to our electronic fingerprint vendor for those processes. And it's just a difference between if they have any sort of history or records they have to just double check in through, that then that would be the employer, the employees here at DPS. We have to just review that, make sure that that person matches that demographics. And if there's no criminal history, it'll automatically forward through and be pushed through to the agency for the results. But that's an automated process if there's no history.
So currently, that process has deteriorated significantly. I think it's probably taking maybe 8 weeks to get someone processed. So when this goes live, are you saying that will significantly reduce the amount of time for an application to be processed?
Yes, sir. So great question. So currently the way it's being designed and implemented, just the way the clearance card team is, if you have a person that wants to, say, get a nursing license, correct? They would go through on the portal. They put their demographics in. They go to the fingerprint vendor. They'll get printed electronically. Those will automatically get tied together in a system under their application. Those fingerprints get automatically sent to the system and ran after a 24-hour check. If the history says that there's no criminal history, those results will automatically be mailed to the Board of Nursing, and our employees will not even touch it. So that'll be a 24 to 48-hour turnaround because it's all automated through the system based off of any responses that get sent out from the FBI or the NCIC, ACIC.
And that'll be a phenomenal improvement. I mean, I get complaints nonstop because of the importance of doing this, but I know you've got your staffing has been decimated. This will be fantastic if you pull this off.
Yeah. Yes, sir. And actually, we have a realistic model to choose that to showcase that from, because the clearance card, if the person has no criminal history that has to be researched, that card never touches a human hand until it even gets automated, put on a letter, folded and put in an envelope, all automatic by machine, and it gets put into a bin, and that's when the human touches it to bring it to the mailroom. Other than that, it's completely automated through the system, so we don't do anything for that. It's done, and it's a one-day turnaround for that.
Fantastic. Mr. Fleetham.
Yeah, Captain. What is the trigger to when you say any sort of history? What's that trigger? Is it felony? What kind of misdemeanor? Where is the trigger? I know it's probably different for nurses than it may be for somebody else. But what is it for? What are you looking at here?
So we don't. So when you look at the applicant processing team, and I'll just speak to two different things. First off, the trigger could be any similarity or anything that comes up. So if I get ran, my criminal history is going to say no results. So, and it has a code inside the system. So once it says that, our system is going to be coded automatically to say no criminal history. It's going to automatically send the results to the agency. So the applicant processing team, they don't make any determination. They gather the information and they forward it to the appropriate agencies to make their own determination for either employment or licensure. So it's a little bit different than the clearance card team, where the clearance card team actually makes the determinations. So where that comes into play with the applicant processing team is if there is a hit, which could be a similarity or some sort of record, they validate that history based off the demographics that are being presented to them to ensure it's the correct person. And if it is a correct person, then they package that together and they send those results to the agency. If it's not the correct person, they delete that history off the record, and then it gets pushed automatically to the agency with no criminal history record.
What kind of timeline is that? I know we run into that when we have background checks that our licensees have to get, it frequently falls back on the county that what they're getting the information from, right? So like a county, say in New York, might take, 6 months to get back, where a county maybe here in Arizona might be, a day. So is there some sort of, am I making any sense here?
Yes, sir. Okay. So There's several different things. They're fingerprint-based checks, so those get already put from the FBI on their NCIC record. Those get pulled, but it's just depending on the jurisdiction in the area for that, and obviously we work to do it as quickly as possible. Right. Arizona's a little bit easier, but hold on a sec. Let me just look up something real quick for you. So I just double checked this is a research only. We just get the information. We don't make determinations. So we'll send those records. And if it says an arrest or conviction, that's the only information we send to the agencies for them to make their determination. So we don't pull arrest reports or anything like that, because we're just a pass through for those type of criminal history requests.
And so then it would be up to the agency to make a determination on how far they're going to carry that then.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's I just wanted to know. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
All right. Any final questions from the committee? Okay. If there are none, I will turn it back to Michael to walk us through the conditions here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. ACID is recommending that the PIDG be approved with the following three conditions. Condition one, should development costs exceed the approved estimates by 10% or more, or should there be a significant change to the proposed technology scope of work or implementation schedule, the agency must amend the PIDG to reflect the changes and submit it to ACID and ITAC if required for review and approval prior to further expenditure of funds.
Mr. Byers.
Mr. Chairman, I move to approve the project with the standard conditions that have been recommended.
Thank you, Mr. Byers. Do we have a second?
Second.
Thanks, Eddie. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, thank you. That's unanimous vote. Thank you, Captain, and DPS team for a good presentation, and good luck with your implementation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Have a good day.
All right, moving on to our next item for review and approval is Department of Water Resources bringing forward their application modernization project.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Again, my name is Karen Whiteford. I'm an engagement manager with the Department of Administration. I'm joined here today by members of the Arizona Department of Water Resources who will introduce themselves after a brief overview of the project. The Arizona Department of Water Resources is seeking approval to modernize its outdated Delphi-based applications with a dynamic customer relationship management, licensure, permitting, and inspection solution that enables ADWR to safeguard the health, safety, and economic welfare of the public by protecting, conserving, and enhancing Arizona's water supplies. At this time, I will turn this over to the project team, who will introduce themselves, present additional information regarding the proposed project, and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Lynn Smith, Deputy Director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources, and we appreciate the opportunity to present our application modernization project today. ADWR is responsible for helping ensure the reliability of water sources for Arizona. We say that DEQ regulates water quality and we regulate water quantity. That's the easy way to think of it. And regulating water quantity can range from negotiating for Colorado River water to regulating dam construction or well construction and a myriad of other complex water processes. Next slide, please. I'd like to introduce the team members that are here with me today. Matt Marshall is our Chief Information Officer, and he's going to present on our technology solution. Scott Saline is our Chief Financial Officer. He'll talk about the project costs and also the benefits of the project. And Ben Alternator is our Chief Legislative Liaison, who is available to help answer questions. Next slide, please. I'd like to start by describing the problems we want to solve. We currently have 10 mission-critical applications that range in age from 2 to 22 years. Our legacy applications haven't always kept up with our business processes, and our legacy development language, Delphi, is challenging to support. In fact, lately, it's increasingly difficult to hire someone who knows Delphi or is interested in learning Delphi. In addition, we have extensive manual data entry and a lack of a uniform way for customers to interact with the department. Finally, we have way too many paper-based processes. Only 23% of our services are available online, and only 30% are completely performed online. Next slide, please. We developed goals of what we would like to do with our application modernization project. Our primary goal is to have a customer-centric online portal. This will reduce the number of manual transactions. We need something with a flexible design that we can grow with us into the future. We're looking for rapid deployment, something that's easy for us to maintain with our application development staff, and a single source of truth that reduces the data silos we currently have in the department. Next slide, please. So in looking at how to achieve these goals, we first looked at doing development in-house, because we do have application developers with extensive water knowledge and business knowledge. However, our staff size is small, and we estimated it would take 6 to 10 years, which is just too long. We heard good feedback on Salesforce from other agencies that have adopted this platform, and so we engaged Salesforce to do a Spark analysis. Based on the feedback from our program and IT staff and the results of that Spark analysis, we developed a request for quotations and sent that to 4 proven vendors with extensive experience in Salesforce. We had an internal committee that reviewed, evaluated, and ranked each of those proposals. And that included going through a formal written response, oral presentations, question and answer sessions. And ultimately, we selected MST Solutions to integrate Salesforce for us. And MST will subcontract through Carahsoft, which is a vendor on state contract. Next slide, please. And with that, I will turn it over to our CIO, Matt Marshall.
We are going to be utilizing the Salesforce Public Sector Foundation's tool to build out our customer portal and internal platform. This system will allow ADWR to develop the new platform quickly and in an agile manner, as it already has applications suited for licensing pre-built and only requiring customization. This platform will allow us to also grow as our needs grow. It will integrate via the MuleSoft platform with our internal databases, including our document management system, DocuShare, and it will integrate with other external systems to ADWR, such as JBilling. Customers and staff will utilize the system via multiple tools, including web, mobile, and email. It will enable staff to process workflows and communicate with customers digitally. If you look at the diagram on the right, you can see a high-level view of this architecture. The agency staff and customers will be interacting with the modernized system through various channels. That modernized system is based on the Salesforce platform. It will interact with the various internal systems and third-party systems through a MuleSoft API integration layer. Next slide, please. The project responsibilities are split among the vendor, MST, and ADWR staff. Starting with ADWR on the left, we'll be managing contract oversight, the subject matter expertise. We'll be providing the staff that are the subject matter experts for the systems being replaced, and we'll conduct the user acceptance testing, review and accept the milestones and deliverables. Moving to the right, the vendor MST will focus on requirements analysis, architecture of the solution, the data model, and configuration and implementation of the software. The shared responsibilities will include project monitoring, data migration, application testing, as well as training and knowledge transfer. The development model for this will include ADWR development staff to increase the ability for ADWR to take on maintenance and future improvements after this project ends. Next slide, please. If approved, this project will start in September of this year, and the first 4 months will be devoted to discovery and design. This phase will involve heavy use of ADWR staff to define requirements for the systems. The next phase will be the development phase, which contains 2 portions, integration phase, which will contain development and configuration, and the data migration, which will consist of moving, cleaning, and developing access methods for the various agency data. This phase will last from January of 2023 to February of 2024. UAT will occur for 2 months, during which regression testing will also occur, and finally, knowledge transfer for the development staff and training for both agency staff and external customers will occur the last 2 months of the project, May and June of 2024. Go live will be at the end of June of 2024. Next slide, please. And Scott Slane will discuss the financials of the project.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just by way of introduction, my name is Scott Saline. I'm the CFO of the Department of Water Resources. What you're looking at here in the left-hand table are the 5-year project costs. I'm going to start down a couple of lines and begin with the $1.7 million from the Automation Projects Fund. We received an appropriation of that amount from the APF as part of the FY23 budget that was passed and signed about 6 weeks ago or so. Moving downward, we also received an appropriation increase to our base budget for the licensing component of this project from another appropriated fund. That's the $2.8 million you see. And then moving back up to the top, we've made $106,000 available from our base budget to fully fund the project. And altogether, over the 5-year period, the project will cost approximately $4.6 million. So moving to the right-hand tables, those tables split out the total 5-year costs into development and operational costs. You'll see that for development, we allocate about $2.9 million of the 4.6 for development. And then for operational, we have about $1.7 million just over for operational over the 5 years. Could you advance the slide, please? So what you're looking at here is the 5-year breakout of costs by fiscal year and then by individual category. So I'm going to start with the top row, professional and outside services contractors. These are the milestone payments that we would pay to the third-party integrators. And we anticipate having costs of about $1.8 million across fiscal 23 and fiscal 24. Then moving downward to licensing and maintenance fees, we anticipate about $2.8 million in licensing fees beginning in FY23 and continuing through FY27. Then going down to the bottom, that shows once again the breakout between development and operational, with about $2.9 million for development and $1.7 million for operational. Could you advance the slide? Measures of success. So to us, this is what success looks like after the project is completed. Success would be if we can unify customer data across all ADWR systems. We anticipate that that will be a big success for us. Additionally, we have set some goals for increasing the percentage of online services and online transactions. For online services, we anticipate bringing it up from currently 23% to about 90%. And then for transactions, from 30% currently to about 75%. And then finally, we anticipate reducing the transaction time by about 25%. Could you advance the slide? So we anticipate that this project will bring numerous benefits, not only to our agency, but to our customers as well. So speaking of a unified customer portal, once the system is complete and live, it will be easier for customers to navigate to the services that they need. And it's also going to improve the speed of our customer interactions that we can do. Accept and follow up on permits and applications online. Just to reiterate, the project will allow us to reduce both customer and staff touch time, which will result in a reduced overall processing time for our application, which will be a huge benefit to our customers. Single source of truth. We've kind of talked about this. Just to give you a short example of this, our field services section, they're a data collection unit within the department. They collect data related to well level measurements. So they'll go to a well and measure how deep they have to go to hit the water, and then they enter that information into a database that they maintain. Now, at the same time, we also have a well section, which a separate unit within our department, which does permitting for well construction, and that issues permits for those wells. And that group currently puts their data into a different database. And those two systems between field services and the well section don't currently talk to each other. And we're confident that by fixing issues like these, we'll have a much more clear picture of ADWR's data, both from a regulatory and a water planning perspective. Could you advance? Thanks for the opportunity to present to you today regarding our proposed application modernization project. We'd be happy to entertain any questions that the committee might have for us.
All right, thank you, team. We'll open it up to the committee for questions. Love, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. In the presentation, you mentioned that you'll be working on the use of MuleSoft in the effort, and I'm just asking whether or not the department has a bench of its own to deal with integrations and has experience actually working with MuleSoft.
No, we do not have in-house staff with expertise in MuleSoft. We are bringing on the partner MST to provide that assistance, and we will be working on training our staff on that product.
Thanks. I would just share, you know, as someone who runs a large MuleSoft shop here at ASU, that it is definitely a tool that requires ongoing caring and feeding. So the idea of training your staff sounds like a good idea.
Any other questions from the committee? Mr. Byers, I'm sorry.
Having worked with a number of integrators with Salesforce, I've discovered that sometimes they're using out-of-country programmers with sometimes very unusual coding. Do you know if MST plans to use out-of-country people, and if so, what the code programming they're going to use?
I am not sure. I believe that the contract allows them to use offshore resources. However, they will need to meet certain coding standards. And additionally, our team will be working with them closely to ensure that we are at least familiar with that, with how they're writing things.
Well, I'll just point of caution. Again, I'm not speaking to your particular vendor. But my experience is with different Salesforce vendors, we've had to undo the code, redo the code. And I would just say it's a thing to really focus on carefully and have a clear understanding of what you're getting, particularly if it's offshore.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Mr. Fleetham.
Yes, Mr. Byers and everybody. We used MST for our system here, and they did have some offshore people in India, all of the clearance. And I think Chairman Sloan would remember that, and some of the others that they were more than accommodating in making sure that everybody was secure through the entire process. And I know the terms that you're using, I'm not necessarily familiar with, but I remember we had to get certain approvals for those things, and they were the MST group was more than accommodating compared to some others that we talked to prior. So
I have my own couple questions, which the things that jump out for me as I look at a project like this specifically are, you've got, you know, I saw the 2 to 22 year age cycle on your applications, which tells me you've got a lot of data. You've got data that has been existing in silos over a long period of time. You're looking to bring that together, and the data migration is generally the most underestimated component of any project like this. And so I'd like, if you can just talk a little bit about whether, have you already done any assessment analysis of the data quality, data cleanliness? Even looking ahead as to how you might approach seeking to merge your data together in a data model. You don't have to go into the detail, but just I'm interested in whether you've already started to look at that and understand the complexities associated with that. Because for any of these systems, you can build a wonderful new system, but if you can't bring your data along with you, it's a tough road.
Yes, we have a data management office that has already started looking and analyzing our data for cleanliness and consistency. This is also why we intend to have the data migration parallel the entire development process. We know it's something that is going to be a critical piece and will take the entire amount of time with development.
Okay. And my last question will be around whether this was part of the Spark process or something you did outside of that. Have you taken a look at your business processes, which, you know, over the length of time that you've had these solutions in place, sometimes we adapt our business processes to the tools we have. Sometimes the tools conform to our processes. But this is one of those opportunities when you're looking to modernize to say, okay, what's our future state business process? What could it look like? And how can we make it, you know, most efficient? And also seek then, I know you're seeking to adopt, you know, it sounds like the public sector tool set. Are there some best practices already built in there that you're able to adapt your processes to help minimize the level of configuration, maybe necessary?
I'll take that one. That is a great question, and it's one of my primary concerns as we've been looking at this solution. We've done a lot of work on reworking our processes through AMS. We've done a lot of work charting out, diagramming our as-is processes so that we can sit down with the integrator and ask, what are the best practices in Salesforce that might shape the way we're currently doing these processes? So we've done a lot of work, but we still have a lot to do because we don't feel that in-house we have the knowledge of what are some of the Salesforce capabilities. And we think that we'll be changing some of our processes. The last thing we want to do is just automate all of our existing processes. We want to take advantage of the new technology.
Excellent. That's what I love to hear. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? If not, I will turn it back over to you, Karen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. ASSET is recommending that the PIDGE be approved with the following three conditions. Should development costs exceed the approved estimates by 10% or more, or should there be significant changes to the proposed technology scope of work or implementation schedule, the agency must amend the PIDGE to reflect the changes and submit it to ADOA, ASSET, and ITAC if required for review and approval prior to further expenditure of funds. Two, monthly reporting on the project status is due to ADOA ASSET no later than the 15th of the month following the project start, the start of the project. Failure to comply with timely project status reporting will affect the overall project health. The first status report for this project is due on September 15th, 2022. Three, prior to go live, the agency must work with the Department of Administration and the Department of Homeland Security Cyber Command to assure the system security plan document is completed and approved by Cyber Command in order to ensure that the selected solution will provide an appropriate level of protection for state data.
All right, thank you, Karen. Any questions on those conditions, folks?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, yeah. I'm going to put it on the record. Mr. Don left the meeting at 2:07, but we still have a quorum.
Thank you. I was about to address that as well, so thanks for bringing that up, Chuck. All right. If there are any questions on the conditions and we've confirmed we still have a quorum, I will take a motion with regard to the project.
I'll move to approve with the conditions as presented.
Thank you, Mr. Fleetham. Do we have a second?
I second.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, that's a unanimous vote. Congratulations, team. Now you get to the real work. Good luck with your implementation, and look forward to hearing good things about your modernization project.
Thank you.
All right, last item for voting this morning is a change request coming to us from the Department of Education on the school finance payment system.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Michael Carpenter. I'm an engagement manager with the Department of Administration. I'm joined here today by members of the Department of Education, who will introduce themselves momentarily after this brief interview with overview of the project. The school financial payment system was originally approved by the committee in January of 2020, with the aim of the project being the modernization of existing legacy public and charter school payment systems. In June of this year, the payment system successfully completed its first year in operation, supporting billions of dollars in state aid payments to schools and districts. The Department of Education is now seeking approval to transition to phase three of the project in order to complete requirements gathering, design, and development of phase one and two enhancements, and to go live with the final phase two budget system. I'll now turn the time over to the project team to present additional information and answer any questions you might have.
Thanks, Michael. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Bethany Lee, I am the CIO for the Department of Education. I'm going to present to you today two things, our July update on our current status and the change request as laid out to you by Michael. I do want to introduce who I have with me here on the call today, and they are available for any questions that you may have. Ben Henderson, our Chief Operations Officer, is with us. We have Lyle Friesen, the Associate Superintendent of School Finance. Myself, Nan Nesvich, who is the Director of IT Project Management and the Project Manager on this project. Kieran Nero, the director of our program management office, and we have Joe Creel with us today, the officer, chief technology officer. Next slide, please. So as I said, I'm going to cover two things today. I'm going to give our July update, and then I will cover the change request. So we will quickly go through the July update for phase two. If you can go to the next slide. So phase two is currently green. We've got two epics in development, one in QA analysis and one in QA testing. We only have one critical deliverable remaining. And we have got, as of July, we had four current risks in the project. Next slide, please. Phase two progress. The current focus of the project was to modernize the school payment system. You heard a little bit from Michael. We've done some team trainings. We've done some the state aid payments and the budget AFR. We are supporting $6 billion in state aid payments. Phase one was well received by the school district. We went live with that with no issues. The team has had quite a few successes in phase two, one of them including the five-month build that we had for the calculations. Six of the eight critical deliverables have been demoed and approved. Phase two will complete on October 24th and will come in under budget. So things are going very well with phase two. Next slide, please. So that's our update on the current phase. So I'm going to go into the change request. Next slide. Thank you. So just a quick overview of the original plan. The original plan, phase one, was August 2020 through June of 2021. Phase one was accelerated. And one of the things that the team did was they included the stakeholder and they rewrote phase two with the stakeholders' involvement. And they realized that there was a lot of missing features from the system. So this caused the team, they did some rethinking and they rethought the length of the project. They created a lot more efficient development methodologies. And they were able to stretch the funds and the time so that they could complete as many features as possible by the end of the project, sticking with the entire plan as outlined here of $9 million. Next slide. This was the approved ITAC for phase two of October of 2021 was when it was approved. Again, we're in development of the last two epics. The school finance business team is preparing to begin the calculation UAT. And as I said, phase two is going to complete on time and under budget. Next slide. So the change request and why we are here today to talk with all of you is to continue the development and implementation of the school finance payment system. We are requesting a couple of things. We're requesting the approval of phase three to add scope and change the timeline in order to complete the requirements gathering, design, and development. That includes phase one and phase two enhancements. We'll be conducting a budget AFR and pilot program, and then the go live for the phase two system. The new timeline in our change request stretches from August of 2022 through April of 2024. There's a couple new scope additions, which include those enhancements in phase one and phase two. The SAFRA report, which is the superintendent's annual financial report, and recent legislative changes that we'll be implementing. The enhancements in phase one and phase two are for efficiencies, some accuracies, and greater performance in the existing system features that have been developed. Next slide, please. This is an overview of the timeline. One of the things that the team is going to do is phase three is going to begin with what we call a deep dive analysis. So we're going to look at all of the requirements across all of the EPICs. This was an exercise that they utilized in phase two. They were very successful with it. It enabled them to focus on the architectural design and the direction, and it really sets them up for less rework and discussion during the requirements meetings. So they're going to repeat that in phase three. The phase three plan is currently 20 months, stretching from August of 2022 through April of 2024. And you can see our high-level milestones outlined here for that phase. Next slide, please. So this outlines some of the deliverables in phase two, some of the enhancements from phase one, the deliverables for phase three, phase one enhancements, phase two enhancements, and what's new to the plan. So we talked about the new items, which you can see, which is the SAFRA report, and then the LEA pilot program. So this is new to the plan, and what they're going to do is they're going to be doing a six-month pilot plan that's going to include some of the LEA stakeholders, and they'll be doing a trial of the product prior to launching. This is going to give us an opportunity to address any of the critical findings with the true end users. So those are our deliverables outlined in the phase three plan. Next slide, please. So this is just a high-level review of the budget. The appropriations for phase one and phase two was $6 million. The total projected spend for phase two is $2.3 million. And that we'll have a remaining appropriation then for $3.6 million. You can see the breakout below for the projected spend for phase three. Pausing for any questions there. All right, next slide. So one of the things that the business and IT spent a lot of time working together, and we really kind of worked through some of the prioritization and some of the efforts that we're going to go into phase three. And after some discussion, after some analysis, there were some things that were omitted from phase three. So the Prop 123 omitted from phase three after discussion. It is a manual process, a minimal number of years. So the decision was made that it wasn't worth the development hours to automate the solution. The LEA data submission of the API, this effort was determined it was going to be about a six-month development effort. So it was not going to be plausible in our current timeline. So the LEAs can maintain their current data submission process without any major impact to school finance. Possible future phase, if they choose to do that. The admin version workflow wasn't really omitted. We ended up completing it with some other workflow documents in phase two. Then one of the other omitted items was the cash advance for signature routing. working with the stakeholder and then the program area, it was designated as a very low priority. It wasn't really worth the investment in the development hours to automate the solution. So out of the original plan, these were the omitted items from that plan. Next slide. So risks and dependencies and constraints in phase three include our resource attrition. We've had this risk. We're going to have it in phase three. We had it in phase one and phase two. Acquiring quality resources for all projects right now has been proven very difficult and challenging. So we've identified the resource attrition as a risk. Requirements not approved by the DRC prior to the start of development. This is a risk that was identified in phase one, and we will continue to carry that through the end of the entire project. Any unknown or unplanned legislative changes that may come, with phase three being a 20-month period, that is something that we identified as a potential risk and unknown. One of the dependencies and one of the constraints that we wanted to document was the stakeholders' business team availability. So when they orchestrated the timeline for phase three, they really took and worked with the business to consider their business teams and their schedules and doing their day-to-day job in the school finance. So we've got to make sure, and we have identified that this is one of our constraints and our dependencies, is to make sure that they are able to engage in the requirements gathering, the approval, and the UAT. So great consideration was taken in the schedule for that dependency and that constraint. Next slide, please. So goal of the proposed plan, just to kind of go back over and start with phase one. So at the end of phase one, the APOR and the CHAR legacy systems no longer being utilized for generating the payments. As we had indicated, that went live June 30th successfully. End of phase two, and the budget AFR and the state aid payments development will be completed. I reviewed that a little bit earlier, and that is pending completion, scheduled June 30th of 2023. The end of phase three, the budget AFR system is going to undergo user acceptance testing, deployment, and the remaining miscellaneous payments. One of the things I want to talk about in phase three is ADE requires several years of data in order to facilitate the 915 reports for the LEAs. So this generally entails 3 to 4 years of old data. So, and that old data resides in that legacy system. As part of phase three, the team is going to accomplish bringing the legacy data forward and will only need to refer to 1 or 2 years over the course of phase three. This is huge, and this migration exercise will assist us in letting that legacy system go faster, letting it go faster than anticipated. So this reduces the risk of that legacy system to ADE. So that will be a huge success. So we've adjusted it then from June of 2024 through versus June of 2027. So we're looking forward to that success at the end of phase three as well. Next slide. So based on the current progress in phase two, adherence to the ITAC conditions and maintaining both the budget and the variance, we are requesting approval today on our phase three plan. It includes to complete the enhancements to the budget AFR and the payment system, complete the SAFR automated reports, conduct the pre-production budget AFR pilot program with the external LEAs, and launch the phase two budget and AFR system by June 30th of 2023. I think our last slide is Q of A. If anybody has got any questions for myself or my team.
All right, we'll open it up to the committee for questions. I'll get you started with one, Beth, which is, because this is a financial system and I see you headed towards a June no later than launch date, is the critical launch date the fiscal boundary, or is your 6 months of pilot starting that July 1 and heading towards an annual boundary?
I'm going to have Lyle confirm that so I do not misspeak. Is that an annual, is that fiscal, Lyle, or is that based on the school year?
The school year and the fiscal year are the same in Arizona anyway. The pilot will be taking place beginning this coming January.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Yeah, I was trying to just see how that all aligned, and I mean, I saw you got a bit of a buffer.
Yes.
Between that March April completion timeline and your June 30th, you know, deadline, that gives you a little bit of slack. So I appreciate seeing that in the plan. So that's it from my perspective. Any other questions from the committee?
Thank you, Lyle.
All right. I will turn it back to Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. ASSET is recommending that the change request be approved with one amendment to the original progress report condition as follows. The Department of Education shall provide informational updates regarding the project's progress and expenditures on a quarterly basis to ITAC unless otherwise requested by ADOA ASSET. ASSET is recommending that all the conditions remain in place and can be referenced in the ITAC PIDGE recommendation document.
Any questions on those conditions, folks? If not, I will take a motion with regard to the project.
Mr. Chair, I move to approve with the conditions. Thank
you, Mr. Cook. Do we have a second?
Yeah, this is Ryan. I'll second.
Thank you, Ryan. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. Mr. Fleeton, did we get your vote?
Yes, I was on mute.
Okay.
Maybe. Right. Sorry.
I saw you unmute after the vote, so I thought I'd check. All right. That's a unanimous vote. Congratulations. Keep up the great work, education, Beth and team. Great to see the continued success in the program.
Thank you.
All right. Our final item today is an informational update from the Administrative Office of the Courts on the CMS replacement project.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Haley Greenberg. I'm an engagement manager with the Arizona Department of Administration. I am joined today by members of the Arizona Administrative Office of the Courts. As conditionally set, the team will introduce themselves, then provide the committee with an informational update to the overall status of their state appellate court's case management solution, and will be returning to ITAC next month for a full change request.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Diana Higgy. I'm the project manager for the project for the Arizona Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals Division 1. And also on the call with us today is our CIO, Carl Heckert, and our project director from Journal Technologies, our vendor, Jason Baddock, is also on the phone. Next slide, please. So as all of you probably remember, we are here to replace a 20-year-old failing case management system with the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals Division 1. And our original pitch had a go-live date of June of 2021. And in November, we had an approval for a new go-live date of January 23. Next slide, please. So we have made progress on our project since our last update in April, and some of the items that we've made progress on include Carl hired a consultant to assess our project, and the consultant is a highly qualified consultant who has experience in working specifically with JTI projects. And the consultant did issue a report. He assessed the project, issued a report, and made some recommendations, which we are in the process of considering. We have collaborated ongoing with ASSET, and I think you'll recall that in April, the court was really struggling with resources, internal resources with our Supreme Court. And I am glad to report that the Supreme Court has filled two positions. So we just currently have one vacancy on our project. We have made some significant progress with our Rules Forum, which is a public forum where members can ask for various rules of procedure to be changed or modified. And it impacts both a website and also the core of the case management project. And we've made some significant progress with that function. We have made significant progress with the Arizona Supreme Court orders. So, you know, the court has to issue many orders, and so we've made significant progress there. The Supreme Court workflows, we'll show you a slide after the slide regarding the workflows, and you'll see that there's been some significant development with the workflows for the Supreme Court. We have resolved some data conversion issues, and our data conversion is going quite well. We have seen a calendar, or what we call a multi-session planner, demonstrated from JTI for our Court of Appeals. The core software had to be given a development ticket so that a panel could be assigned to a case instead of just one judge, one case. And so we have made significant progress in that regard. And we've really had some great collaboration between the Court of Appeals and JTI on minutes, which is the way that the Court of Appeals will issue orders in the future using the minutes module within the eCourt. And we have progressed on our UI testing. I think last time you'll recall in April, we were having some internal difficulties keeping up with the testing because of the vacancies and because we're now kind of in a compressed development schedule with some of the delay in the development of our software. Next slide. So this is a breakdown looking at the workflow matrix from April to July. And while we still have only three workflows complete, and in this instance, complete means ready to be deployed, you can see that many more have been configured and are ready for testing and or are actually in system testing. So you can see that is the progression of how the workflows are going. And the workflows are really, you know, a way to modernize the work of the courts instead of doing the work through email and, you know, kind of walking paper around the building. The workflows will allow the automation of many of the business processes. Some of them are complex and some of them are, you know, a little easier. The Supreme Court workflows seem to be less complex than the Court of Appeals workflows. And the focus really has been to focus more on the function for the Supreme Court and trying to wrap up many of those items and then moving to the Court of Appeals. Next slide, please. Unfortunately, I have to report that we've considered the overall project health is of our project to be red, and because the January 23 go live date is at risk. And as Haley mentioned, we will be back for a change request to extend time probably next month. We can look at the details about why the project is red, but mainly the project status is red because we will not meet the go live date of January 23. We are working together with a consultant and the vendor to mitigate the issues and try and resolve as many issues as we can so that we can go live as soon as we can. And we'll be reassessing the items that are still needed in development and configuration before we come back to this committee for a new go live date. The risks largely remain the same from the last time we provided an update, and that is that eCourt's very flexible, and sometimes it's difficult to nail down a certain scenario because there are so many options. The configuration of the workflows, the document searches and reports, those are all things that are still pending, although that we've made progress in two of those areas. And then our project has several integrations, and including a new third-party e-filing system that we'll be integrating with in the future. So those are all our risks. And our plan to mitigate these risks is to develop a detailed task for each of these mitigated, each of these integrations to make sure that we can move forward in a positive way. The issues are still kind of the same as reported in April. The resource bandwidth due to competing project, parallel projects. Our team is working in their regular jobs and also working on this project. So we are evaluating that process. We are reviewing the consultants' reports and recommendations to determine which recommendations we will follow and implement. Internally, we are determining our UI testing protocol, and we'll finish that in the next month or so, and we're working with our vendor to develop a more detailed project plan to track the project at a task level so that we can ensure that our new go live date will be a reliable go live date. Next slide. These are the areas that we measure for the overall project health, and we have case structure and financial structure are complete, and that is where we can take a case off the shelf and enter all the data that's needed to open a case. And the financial structure has really mostly to collect filing fees for the various documents or people filing. And then I've mentioned the interfaces. We believe that is in the red zone. Our data conversion is in the yellow zone. The public portal, so part of this project will have a website where members of the public can enter to the website and find out information about their case or other cases. We've made some progress on the public portal, but we still have work to do. Same with workflows. We think that we're almost 60% complete with workflows. Documents are considered yellow, and the rest of the project we think is considered red. Next slide, please. So that concludes our informational update, and it's Haley mentioned we will be back with a change request for an extension of time.
Okay, does the committee have any questions on this? I have one, which would be you engaged a consultant, you received recommendations. I see that there's a plan to review those recommendations. When is that review expected to be completed?
Mr. Chairman, we have started the review of that report, and we've made some initial decisions, but there are other decisions that we need to make regarding how to move forward with some of the project milestones and planning.
Okay, so it sounds like that's in process, but will be complete before you come back with your change request.
That's correct.
Okay. Can you characterize the types of recommendations that you received?
There were a variety of recommendations, and one of them had to do with whether we could phase part of the project, move toward a phased approach of the project. So a pilot where we would go live with, say, like the rules forum part of the project, and then go live with one court, and then go live with the second court. So there were different, you know, different phased approach options to consider, or to try to keep the same path and it just extend the timeline for the project. So that was part of it. The other recommendations really have to do with the overall management and tracking of the project and some of the ideas that the consultant implemented in his own project that really helped move the project forward.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. If there's not any other comments from the committee members, thank you, Diana, and court's team for being here. That is the final item on our agenda for today. Our next meeting is currently scheduled for September 21st. And we will see you all then. I will call the meeting to a close. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, let's go ahead and stop the recordings and the presentation.